STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi there. This is STR Ask. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel. Hi there.
Hi there.
Why are you laughing?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's because it's that time again where we do radio, and I just seem to always laugh when you start by saying, hi there. I don't know.
What do you suggest I say?
Howdy. I don't know. You're doing it just fine. It's just, I guess it's better to start laughing than crying, right?
That's true. We'll cry at the end. So anyway, so I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel. This is STR Ask, hashtag STR Ask, the name of the podcast, because that's how you send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STR Ask and less than 140 characters.
You know, I was just thinking that let's just have a normal opening. I'm just going to sit here and not do anything.
Yeah, I thought, I looked across and you looked distracted. So I thought, okay, we're just going to go into this normal.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then you started laughing.
It's
becoming a habit.
Okay.
You know, laughing for no reason is a symptom of going crazy. Or senility, which is very possible.
No. The second symptom of senility is hair in your palms. You have any?
Hair in your palms?
Yeah. You never checked?
I know there's no hair in my palms.
Well, she's not falling for it because she's supposed to look, and then I say the first sign.
Why would I look at my palms if there's hair in my hands? Hair doesn't grow
well,
in hands.
I should have said hair on the back of your hand
let's
or something.
Let's just go on, okay? This is ridiculous.
This was something I learned in the third grade.
Yeah, see?
It worked then.
See? Third grade stuff. That's what I always say. Men always revert to third grade behavior. Okay, so let's just move on to something serious. This is the STRS podcast. It's the short podcast. Greg answers questions in 4 minutes or less, and hopefully he'll give you greater than a third grade answer. All right, so here we go, okay?
Okay.
First question comes from J.M. Mall. How do you conduct apologetics with someone who doesn't connect with good arguments and doesn't think logically?
Well, I think the best way to pursue that, if you are going to pursue it, and sometimes those circumstances aren't worth pursuing. I mean, you just have to make an assessment early on if you're just going to get blather from somebody or if they've just got attitude. And I remember one occasion where a person announced that he was an atheist at a dinner party and he really was not interested in having any kind of conversation. I tried to engage him a little bit, and there was just nothing to pursue, okay? And sometimes you just drop it, okay, and move on. But I think this is where the tactical approach really shines, because if a person isn't willing to use logic, sometimes by asking them questions, you can get them to put in a certain sense, pieces on the table that they acknowledge are legitimate pieces, and then you use their pieces to suggest, show that they are mistaken about something, that their pieces lead logically to this particular end. Now, I know the questioner said, what if they're not thinking logically? It's a lot harder for them to simply gainsay, dismiss your point of view if what you have done is incorporated a whole bunch of pieces that are their assertions, basically, into your response, because they can't very well gainsay or dismiss their own statements. And so one classic way I do this is I ask people if things exist. Yes, they do. Now he says things exist. Great. Have things always existed? Is the universe eternal? No. In other words, it came into being at some time. Yeah, the Big Bang. Okay, now I got a commitment from that person to Big Bang cosmology. Great. What banged the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? Well, I don't know. Well, there's only two categories, something or nothing. That's pretty much all-inclusive. Something did or nothing did. And those are your only two choices. Okay, now they put all the pieces on the table, and I've asked a question regarding those pieces, and I've made the response very easy for them, because there are only two alternatives. And if they balk there and they want to suggest a third alternative, I can let them do so. But there is no such thing as a third alternative, given the way the question is raised. There is no third alternative between something and no thing. It's either A or not A, you know.
You're such a binary thinker.
So, again, the concern is, what about a person who's not willing to think rationally? Sometimes when you step them through it and you leave them with very simple options, you can make more headway if you're not being obnoxious about it. And but it may be that this is a person who simply doesn't want to follow you anywhere because they're not interested in having an intelligent discussion about something. In that case, you can just break off the discussion. Normally, though, the opposition is attempting to give reasons for their view. They may not be very good reasons, but they're attempting to, and that's putting them in play.
Well, how about if in the question, what he's referring to is maybe somebody who's not so left brain, not so much interested in arguments, but is more the creative type, isn't as used to talking about arguments and stuff. How would you?
Yeah, well, that's another circumstance. I know two times this week and one time last week, I'm giving this talk called Naturalism Bumping into Reality. And so I make two points that are, in a certain sense, left-brain kinds of points. And it turns out to be basically a cosmological argument and a moral argument. But the last one has to do with the existential problem. Now, that's all highfalutin language. You don't have to use the language when you're talking to people. But the fact is, every human being has to live in a world that he's trying to make sense of. And there are particulars that every human being is aware of. And one of the things that they're aware of is that humans are special in some way, but they're also deeply broken. And it's not just humans, but they are special and they are broken. And most of the time, almost everybody is in touch with their brokenness, even if they're not in touch with their specialness. But this is the existential problem. What worldview makes sense of the inner brokenness that we experience, the hunger that we have for meaning and significance and truth, the moral realities that we see about the world? What makes sense to the things that make us, in a certain sense, emotionally tick? And so I think of this talk that I gave at Berkeley a number of years ago, in which I said essentially everybody in the audience experiences guilt. And I used some questions with the audience to get them to kind of put that piece on the table, you know. Guilt, they told me. Well, why do we feel guilty? Well, maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Mm-hmm. And the answer to guilt, I said, is not denial. The answer to guilt is forgiveness. So in that particular case, I am speaking directly to the existential element, the emotional element, if you will, the awareness that people have that they're fallen, and the solution that Christians can offer, which is forgiveness. And just saying forgiveness is the answer, I think, has a certain power to it, and that speaks to their existential need.
Is your phone right?
5 minutes and 40 seconds, I
think.
For
that answer?
I'm not sure. Maybe I.
No, just because I asked him a related question. I didn't add to the discussion, so you keep the timer going. Yeah, we should have dinged you on that one.
Okay.
Sorry, folks.
Thank you.
We let him go over time.
Better late than never, right?
Okay, next question. Mm-hmm. From General Nate One on Twitter. How do we deal with betrayal from within the Christian community? I'm speaking from past experience.
It depends, I guess, on the kind of betrayal it is. Betrayal can happen on a lot of different levels, and so there are many slights. I almost said slight slights, but what I mean is minor slights that we may experience that Jesus seemed to indicate we should just turn the other cheek with regarding. I think that was his point in that passage in Matthew chapter 5 or 6, the Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek. That is, when you get slapped backhandedly, is when you look closely at the text, this seems to be what it's indicating. When you get slighted in some way, insulted, well, you don't return evil for evil, okay? Some things we just let go. It says in Proverbs that it is a man's glory to overlook a transgression. So sometimes we just say, oh, that was kind of nasty, but, you know, I'm just going to let it go. And that's the best thing to do. Now, there are other times when the betrayals are more egregious. Sometimes even in egregious betrayals, I think we have to ask ourselves, what good will a confrontation do in this circumstance? Sometimes you're going to ask yourself that question, and the answer is going to be, well, it probably is not going to do any good. The person's going to get just mad and then badmouth you to other people. And so maybe even in some more weighty cases, it's better just to let it go. On the other hand, there are cases where it's not going to be the kind that you have to let go. Maybe the betrayal relates to an actual sin that is weighty and egregious. And then I think Matthew 18 has directions that Jesus gives about correcting a brother. Galatians chapter 6 talks about when a brother's caught in a stumble, you who are spiritual, restore such one in a spirit of gentleness, looking to yourselves lest you also stumble. And so there is a whole kind of attitude that you pick up, a feeling you pick up from that passage. If you're going to go to correct somebody, go with grace, to put it another way, and being mindful that, you know, we've all been there kind of thing. It's hard to get any more specific, though, about how to respond unless I have the specific answer in question. Maybe there has been circumstance of a betrayal represents, say, a financial betrayal. Somebody has swindled you out of money. Well, interestingly, the New Testament has a lot to say about swindlers, and well, I shouldn't, maybe not a lot, but it has some to say about swindlers. And I think in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul, when he's talking about the local church addressing that egregious moral sin, sexual sin, he reiterates that I told you not to associate with sinners that are in the body, not outside of the body. And I actually wrote you verse 11, chapter 5, not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person, covetous, an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a swindler. Not even to eat with such a one. So some things like those are more egregious sins and need to be responded to, sometimes in the context of corporate discipline. In other times, just breaking off the relationship, like Paul says, you just don't even eat with that person. You don't treat them as a member of the body because they are living outside of the boundaries of proper Christian behavior.
Next question comes from Deation on Twitter. Can one question the deity of Christ by arguing that he was raised by another, like all other resurrections in the Bible?
You mean meaning that Jesus was raised by the Father,
mm-hmm.
and therefore he wasn't God?
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if that were true, I don't see how that undermines the deity of Christ. If you think of the economic Trinity, what I mean by that is the idea that each member of the Trinity does something different. They have different roles. Like the Spirit regenerates, the Father gives believers to the Son. We see that in John 10 and John 6. The Son dies for sin, so they're different functions, okay? Maybe it's the function of the Father to raise Jesus from the dead. I don't see how, if the Father has a function that the Son doesn't have in their unique persons, I don't see how this makes somehow undermines Jesus' divinity. So even if the statement were true, I don't see how that causes a problem, but the statement's not true, because the Scripture does talk about the Father raising Jesus from the dead, but it also talks about Jesus raising Jesus from the dead, and this is in John chapter 5. It's early on in Jesus' ministry, and let me see if I can find it. It's a long chapter, but I'll tell you what it says if I don't find it here exactly. It says that, tear down this temple, Jesus said. Maybe it's not in John 5. It's when he was cleansing the temple. But anyway, he said, I'll tear down this temple, and I will raise it up on the last day.
Oh, yeah, I was just reading that yesterday or today. I think it's John maybe 3 or 4.
Okay, I'm just looking for the heading now. No, 3 is Nicodemus. But in any event, it's early on in his ministry, and and
it's the first time he cleansed the temple.
Yes, that's right. And the disciples, well, what the text says, this he meant in reference to his soma, his body. And so it was a prediction of the resurrection, but the disciples didn't understand it until later. So Jesus says, I will raise this temple up, referring to his body. So Jesus, it could be said that Jesus self-consciously raised himself from the dead, which is rather unique.
Mm-hmm.
So we have passages that say God raised Jesus from the dead and Jesus raised Jesus from the dead. So there you have actually an argument for the Trinity, not an argument against the Trinity.
Okay, last question. I thought I was going to have to cut back on this one, but you were so short on that one. I'll give you full time on this one. How can I effectively mobilize? This comes from Bael Shaddai on Twitter. How can I effectively mobilize the youth around me in the area of Christian apologetics? This is timely, considering Solid Ground.
Yes, Solid Ground this month deals with how parents can disciple their children in being good ambassadors for Christ, which includes the issue of apologetics. But, you know, when I think about motivating young people, I always think of the technique that Brett uses so frequently with youth groups by role-playing as an atheist with the group. And maybe here's the way I would put it in brief, and then I'll describe the details. The way we motivate young people with regards to apologetics is we beat them up. That is, Brett will go into a youth group somewhat disguised as an atheist. When I say disguised, that means that the young people do not know that he's a Christian apologist, even though the youth group leader does. He is hired to role play an atheist, which he does really well.
And sometimes some of the other youth workers don't know either.
That's correct, because they'll try to get into the mix and they fare as poorly as the rest of the students.
Sometimes, yeah.
So and so he's introduced as Dr. Such and So from the local junior college as an atheist, and he's going to give a talk about atheism for 15 minutes, and then they're going to open it up for Q&A. Well, of course, the kids are mortified. Who let that guy in here, you know, in the sanctum sanctorum? We're not supposed to have atheists in our group. Plus, they're afraid that something the atheist is going to say is something they can't deal with, which, of course, is true. Everything that Brett offers, they are not able to deal with. And when they give a chance to have Q&A afterwards, then they do not fare well. Now, Brett is always nice.
Mm-hmm.
He's never abusive, but he just outmaneuvers them and outthinks them because they don't have much to think about with regards to their Christian convictions. And so the shallowness of their ability is demonstrated. Now, keep in mind, they think that he's an atheist that now has just pulled the rug out from underneath them. And so they're a bit forlorn. And the point here, of course, is to motivate them, to help them to see what they don't know.
Right, because he starts that way, but what usually it's the beginning of the session or it's the first session, which then he's going to turn around and start teaching and training them.
Yes, that's right. In the sessions
now
that
they're properly motivated.
After the session's over, then he confesses this is a ruse, this is a setup. But let's talk about what happened and how you feel, and let's have you grade yourself. And a lot of times the students grade themselves poorly, but higher than what Brett grades them based on his assessment. But that is one of the best ways of getting people to be motivated about apologetics is to put them in circumstances where they're going to need them.
And you can do that by role-playing yourself, bringing other people in, but you can also do it by taking them to the local mosque or the local Hindu temple and letting them talk with
right.
the people there. Brett sets these trips up. You can also go to a local campus and give the kids a questionnaire. Mm-hmm. And even if they don't do well the first time, what you do is you come back and you use that as now opportunities to teach. And Brett mm-hmm. has taken students out, and they get better and better and better. And boy, they start pouring over their Bibles because now they're really motivated. Mm-hmm. And they're excited because their confidence increased because they know there are answers once they start
right.
looking for them and being taught.
His article identifies a teaching understanding, a medieval understanding called the trivium, that identifies three different developmental stages, the grammar stage, the logic stage, and the rhetoric, roughly correlating to grammar school, middle school, and high school. But it just identifies these different areas, and specifically in this May solid ground, how we can take, as parents, take advantage of those things to train our kids.
Right. And youth leaders and other church leaders.
Right, exactly.
Brett said my niece's apologetics class at Lutheran High Orange was one of the best classes in giving him a run for his money.
Oh, that's good.
And,
that's great.
My niece, of course, knew who he was, but the other kids didn't, but mm-hmm. they were well prepared.
Well, so. I quiz my daughter, Annabeth, because she's in the logic stage. I don't expect my Eva to be able to kind of work through some of these problems. She can give right answers to things at the stage she's at, but giving a defense for it is different. But even when Annabeth gives a defense, I don't expect it to be rhetorically sophisticated. That'll mm-hmm. come later.
Right.
So
right.
we can do these things with our own kids.
Yep. That's it for this week, folks. You can send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STRAsk, the name of the podcast. This is posted Mondays and Thursdays, two episodes a week now. It's available in all the usual places. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.